Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. Though it seemed like it was 10 years ago, it was last February, following the Iowa caucuses, that I had two analysts on the program to discuss the results and look ahead. They join me again today to discuss the results of the general election. Michael Backus is the recently reelected clerk of Oswego County. He has served on the staff of Republican Congressman John McHugh and State Assemblyman Brian Kolb. He's also a former Oswego County Republican chairman. Chris Farisee is a political science professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Prior to becoming an academic, he had experience as field director for Democrat David Fink's congressional run in Michigan. He's also the author of a book titled Welfare for the Wealthy. Welcome back, both of you, to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael, congratulations on your reelection.
Thank you very
much. With no opposition,
but
congratulations anyway.
Good way to run for office.
Chris, let me start with you. What a long, strange trip this has been. The basket of deplorables had the last laugh. So my question to you first is, losing to Donald Trump, how humiliating of a defeat is this for the Democratic Party and for the legacy of the Clintons?
It's a tremendous blow. It really can't be overstated. Donald Trump had the highest unfavorability ratings of anyone ever running for president and still won. Hillary Clinton outraised Donald Trump. She had a better ground campaign than Donald Trump and a bigger get-out-the-vote effort and still lost. So I think that this is definitely damaging to her legacy, the Clinton legacy, and is really going to cause some soul-searching for the Democratic Party going forward.
Now, for both of you, but I'll stick with you, Chris, and then we'll get Mike in on this. It seems like at least, you know, it's just the day after, but at least the punditry that I've been able to see so far last night and this morning, it seems like it's a lot about how Trump won, what he did, how he got more white people to vote for him while stemming the damage among other groups of voters. But I remember back in 1992 when Bill Clinton won the first time, and they had the day after or second day after press conference with the campaign people. Jim Carville was talking, and he was explaining the win. And he said, I remember this, he said, first thing you got to remember, we had a good candidate. Is this more a question of how Clinton lost? Is the problem with her as a candidate?
I think it is to an extent. Clinton was known to voters coming into the election, and people had a lot of hard, stable opinions about her before she ran her first ad, before she gave her first speech. And in a lot of ways, she was unable to get out of her own shadow during the course of the campaign, either through coming up with some type of unifying narrative or through her ability to kind of energize a lot of Obama's coalition from 08 and 12.
And Michael, what
do you just to jump in, I think that it almost came down to, you know, Hillary, she just never could get out there and get that energy that I think she wanted to have in that 08 campaign. She came out, you know, she was aggressive against President Obama. She never really was like that in this campaign against Donald Trump. And I think that I do agree 100%, Grant, that this testament, as the history of this election is written, it's really going to come down to how horrible a candidate it ended up being Hillary Clinton really was. And it's not necessarily that, you know, the legacy of the Clintons or anything else. It's the drip out of WikiLeaks. It's the email concern. It's the history of the Clinton family and the Clinton Foundation, the things that people just said, I just don't trust her. And while, yes, Donald Trump had high unfavorables, no question about that, Hillary had very high unfavorables, and she had been in public life for 30-plus years. I think that truly will end up being the story of this entire campaign. I can't agree more. And it's really going to be interesting to see how they transition out of this. How does the history of a former president, a secretary of state, a U.S. senator, and almost another president from the same
twice
family
almost.
In the same household, mm-hmm. twice almost. That's a great way to put it. How does that story get written? Because that is it's a fascinating thing. And, you know, to go down to Donald Trump and to come up short there in this kind of environment, boy, I really think it does come down to how challenging of a candidate Hillary Clinton ended up being.
Chris, and I want
to. Although one thing I jump in quickly is that right now she's leading in the popular vote.
Right. As of today.
And, you know, all the models I've looked at predict that she will end up with more votes than Donald Trump. So, again, we have a situation like 2000 where the Democratic candidate will have received more votes but lost in the Electoral College.
Well, can I just jump in there, Grant? Sure. While I agree with that, I'm looking at CNN right now on the popular vote, and it's 59,248,281 for Clinton, 59,095,000. So you're really only talking about 150,000 people difference at that point. So while I guess it may look like that Clinton does indeed come up,
they're still waiting for some of the West Coast.
They are. This is with 92% of in. Yeah. If that's going to be the holding, that's another testament, I think, to what Clinton really struggled with.
So Chris, come back to you on pursuing this a little bit. Do you think that? Because the last time I think we were together here, I remember you saying something about Democratic Party had cleared the deck for Hillary Clinton to be the nominee. So do you think the party's going to go through a rethink of that? I mean, are they going to rethink how did we do the superdelegates? Do we need to set this up differently? Do we need to try to think about the bench from the beginning rather than identify the star? I mean, what lessons does the party draw from this?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I had talked about a potential civil war within the Republican Party, and I would have to say that I think that's on pause right now. Where there might be an oncoming civil war is within the Democratic Party, and the centric liberalism that Hillary Clinton and the Clinton family represented is going to have difficulty being the defining ideology of the Democratic Party going forward. I think that there are going to be Sanders supporters and Elizabeth Warren and others who make the argument that they have a message that would appeal to the white working class as well as the kind of Obama coalition that needs to be what the party stands for going forward.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Professor Chris Farisee and Oswego County Clerk Michael Backus. I want to look forward from here, think about what Trump presidency will mean given what happened in the Senate, what happened in the House of Representatives last night. But let me stick with this just for a minute. And Michael, I'll come back to you with this. Was there something about the results last night that we haven't talked about so far that caught your eye? Like, wow, that surprised me, or that's worth noting?
The coattails. I was really amazed that Donald Trump had as strong a coattail as he did, especially in some of these swing states. And, you know, I look at Florida. I was an early Marco Rubio supporter. I'm glad to see that he did return to the Senate. I did not expect to see him win that definitively in Florida, but I think he did that because Donald Trump did so well. Mm. And I think that played out across the rest of the country in a lot of different ways. You know, you can look at this from a winners and losers standpoint. You know, it's really going to be an interesting component to see how now with both houses of Congress, you have the perfect, you know, governing strategy if you really want to push forward an agenda. Donald Trump's now going to have to articulate what that agenda is, and that's going to be the challenge that we look at going forward. But in terms of surprises, the coattails that he had, some of the sweep that he got from a number of different swing states that I thought would be much, much more competitive, especially for Senate races, man, they came forward for him, and people came out and got further down the ballot than I thought they would.
Chris, what struck you?
Yeah, so I agree with the coattail. You know, I think that Burr in North Carolina, Blunt in Missouri, and especially Johnson in Wisconsin can owe their seats, in effect, to the Trump effect. What surprised me is the high turnout among working class whites in rural areas. If you go county by county and compare Trump's results to Romney's in 12, the amount of people he was able to turn out in rural areas of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, North Carolina, far surpassed Romney's numbers. And this was without a lot of television advertising. This was without a traditional GOTV campaign. So the high turnout among working class rural whites really kind of calls into question what we know about campaigns.
Let me ask you about that turnout, because the story that I've heard, at least up until this morning on NPR, was somewhat different about that issue. It wasn't that turnout was higher, but it was that Trump was winning a much higher percentage of those whites that did turn out, and the turnout looked comparable. Are you seeing something different when you look more at a micro level, state by state, or?
Yeah, so I was looking at county maps this morning, okay. And you know, I'm looking at, for example, Southeast Ohio. There is more turnout in those areas. Some parts of Northeast Wisconsin.
Southeast Ohio is basically it's considered Appalachia. It's part of what the Appalachian Regional Commission considers Appalachia.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was basing that on the countywide results.
And one of the interesting things that I found from that, I found this on Twitter from an NPR source, that in 12, Obama got 65.9 million. In 2016, Clinton right now, and not everything's in, I'll give you that, she's 6.8 million voters behind that number. That, I think, really comes down to it. Yes, Trump's 1.9 million behind where Romney was from a popular vote standpoint. And there's still some to be counted, I agree. But that 6.8 million. That's a lot of people that showed up to vote for President Obama that didn't come out for Clinton. So while I agree that there may be some pieces for Trump, I really think, again, that this is a testament to Hillary.
It's interesting, too, that both of you are talking about the Senate coattails. And, Chris, you really kind of enumerated all the different individual races that you identified that way. You know, the narrative going into yesterday was how much these folks were going to get hurt.
Yeah.
By their – whatever their association with Trump was, how loose or how much they had tried to break, but how much this would bring them down. It flipped around completely.
Yeah, and I think that's – you know, as you look forward, you know, there's already starting to people, you know, say, the polls – David Axelrod, I thought, had a great point last night. I think one of the hosts on CNN asked him, you know, what did the pollsters get wrong? He said, the numbers. It really was that simple. And I think that, you know, I want to give a little bit of due deference. I think there was you know, there's some issues with polling, and I think there's going to be a lot of things that come out in the next little bit on it. It really, for candidates that kind of just walked that fine line between supporting Trump, not supporting Trump, nobody was really sure. Nobody could really get that 100% I feel comfortable with this or that. And it ended up just being there was that silent wave that came out. Especially in a lot of those swing states.
Before we go look forward, Chris, I want to ask you about the polls. I've had several conversations with different colleagues about this. They have different views. I always wondered whether the polls were systematically underreporting Trump support because of what, you know, we would call the social desirability function, the effect, you know, that I'm going to vote for Trump, and I think I know that, but I'm not going to tell a pollster that because I also know it doesn't look good. Mm-hmm. Particularly maybe if my spouse is in the room, if I'm getting that phone call, that kind of effect. Do you think that happened and one of the reasons why they got it so wrong?
No. So there is a great study done by a friend and colleague at Cornell, Peter Enns, along with his students in a public opinion class. And they were able to demonstrate constructing and implementing a national poll that people weren't shy about saying they were going to vote for Trump. But the people who said they were going to vote for Trump were considered to be low probability voters, right? Irregular voters who, when people were modeling based upon these samples, if you look at the voting histories of the people who said they were going to vote for Trump, you weren't sure whether they were going to turn out in the polls based upon their own past history, but they did.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Oswego County Clerk Michael Backus and political science professor Chris Farrisee, and we're discussing the election outcomes and what they might mean for the country politically going forward. Michael, there are a lot of moving parts to yesterday's results. You have the presidency, you have the Senate, you have the House, so it's hard to talk about the impact of any single one of them. But to try to put them all together, how much of an open door does Donald Trump have to pursue whatever policy objectives he might fix upon? And we need to talk about what those might be. It's a little bit unclear, but whatever they are, you know, how much of an open door does he have to walk through?
Considerable. I mean, it's a considerable open door. I think that there's, you know, we talked a little bit about already, you know, what this impact is going to be from a policy standpoint on the country. You know, what does now Paul Ryan do? Wisconsin going in favor of Donald Trump, you know, that's a huge effort. You know, what does the Speaker of the House, so does he try to drive it? Does he try to move policy that he wants to push? Does Donald Trump allow that to happen? You know, what does Rents Priebus try to do, the RNC chair? You know, there's rumors of him becoming maybe potentially chief of staff. Does he try to drive that bus? It's really undefined at this point. And, you know, I think that some of the gambles that Senate Republicans made, I think the Supreme Court, one of the main reasons why a lot of Republicans did, I think, come home to Donald Trump was a concern about where does the Supreme Court go. Without question, one of the winners in this election is Mitch McConnell. He made a gamble and he said, I'm not going to bring Merrick Garland forward for a Supreme Court hearing even. And by doing that, he has potentially preserved the Supreme Court in conservative ideology for maybe a generation. You know, let's see where that goes. Let's see what Donald Trump actually does, because I'll think anybody that would sit in this chair or anywhere else on anywhere else, I don't think anybody truly understands or knows where Donald Trump wants to go from a policy perspective. I think he very much has to delineate that in a very, very short amount of time.
Chris, do you think his likely tactic will be to try for something big early on, like, you know, an immigration overhaul, or do you think he'll look for something more doable where he can find common ground? Like, for example, in his speech last night, he talked about one specific thing he talked about at some detail was infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So maybe he'll start with infrastructure and get something done there. How do you think he's going to approach this?
So I would say infrastructure would be a good start because it has some bipartisan support. But he made big promises to his base that his base is going to expect him to deliver. The wall, possibly a deportation force. I mean, these were the defining issues. A Muslim ban. So there's going to be pressure on his base for him to deliver on the most high-profile promises. And these promises have real political risk for other Republicans. You know, demographics aren't destiny, but there is a growing Latino population in the Sun Belt. And right now you have the incentives of individual Republicans possibly aligned with Donald Trump. But if there's a push for some type of wall building or deportation force, I think you're going to get pushback from some of those Southern Republicans with growing Latino populations.
Michael, I want to follow up on that. But first, I just want to remind folks, if you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Chris Farrisee and Michael Backus. Michael, Chris was talking about some things that executive orders might be able to do, at least for some of them. What kinds of things do you think that Donald Trump can realistically do through executive orders, directing the executive branch to do certain things without getting the kind of backlash that Chris was intimating there?
Well, and that's going to be very, very difficult. And it's going to be hard to define what Donald Trump, given the campaign promises that he's made to his base very, very specifically. And I want to also separate out kind of some of the things that he said during the primary debates versus some of the things he said in maybe the last month and a half, because I think those are two very different conversations. And I think Kellyanne Conway deserves a lot of credit for changing the narrative, taking away the Twitter from Donald Trump's fingers. But I think from a policy standpoint, you know, yeah, I think he's going to have to make some very quick decisions in terms of executive orders to derive an understanding of where he wants to see the nation go and go quickly. I'm not sure that there's any definition to that. I'm just not sure that there's one specific policy. He didn't outline that last night. Mm-hmm. And my opinion, if he focuses purely on rebuilding America, if he turns that Make America Great Again slogan into rebuilding America, and however he wants to define that with consultation with people like Paul Ryan, Rance Priebus, and some of the Senate leaders that are now going to be in much more power, they're going to have a lot of ability now. That might be where he does answer some of those more nasty campaign promises. Maybe he goes after and does solve the immigration issue in a way that doesn't go through an executive order, because I think that would be – I think immediately a lot of those Senate Republicans immediately will come back and say, whoa, 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 not going to be able to get this funded, not going to be able to move this through the House. Let's make this more of a policy position that is a little bit more palatable. I think that Senate bill that came up –
Do it legislatively.
Yeah, I think that Senate bill that did came up, you'll see that come up again. A lot of Senate Republicans that are coming back were part of that. Marco Rubio is coming back to the Senate. I think you see him be a very strong voice there too. Donald Trump said some very, very good things about him. He knows that Florida – but both helped each other in Florida, and I think Donald Trump will respect that.
Chris, going back to the Supreme Court, Michael mentioned that. How far do you think he can push with his nominees there? Because, you know, the Senate is still relatively closely divided. And the other question is, do you think the older justices who are not on the conservative side are now going to be like you know, hanging on there with their fingernails and three doctors around them for the next 4 years.
So when you were writing the speech last night about a possible Clinton narrow victory, there's the possibility that she might be able to fill three Supreme Court seats, right? You had not only the Maryland Garlick, but you had maybe Breyer and Ginsburg. And now I think there is going to be pressure on Breyer and Ginsburg to hang on as long as possible to not give those seats, because as Michael mentioned, I mean, that would make a overwhelming conservative court for possibly a generation. So it's already going to go back to being 5-4. So I think there's going to be pressure to make sure it just stays 5-4 and doesn't go to be 6-3 or 7-2.
So let me ask about – we haven't talked about foreign policy yet. We don't have a whole lot of time left and it's a huge issue. But I guess in the vein of silver lining perhaps for some liberal Democrats here in this loss – do you think, Chris, I'll stick with you, do you think our chances perhaps for being in another ground war in the next 4 years just went down a little bit as opposed to Hillary Clinton? Because Trump did seem less keen on that kind of overseas commitment, a little bit less uncertain about what he wanted to do with airplanes with bombs. But it does seem like that was not something that he was as keen on as Clinton might have been.
I'm not so sure. I mean, we elected someone with no political experience, with seemingly very few core policy beliefs, whether it be foreign or domestic. So I think there, you know, this is where I agree with Michael. There's real questions about what happens with all types of policy. And while maybe a lack of ground troops might be somewhat heartening, the talk about allowing other countries to have nuclear weapons scares the hell out of me. The idea of not protecting NATO allies scares me, and I think about international stability. So the effect of Russia and the propensity to kind of give compliments to authoritarian leaders, I think all are cause for concern with foreign policy.
And perhaps maybe a staff and being part of an institution may trim that back. We've only got about another minute and a half or two left, but I did want to also turn to this. Michael, obviously, this has, I think, some effect on how we're going to view the Obama presidency. And in some ways, we might think of this as the final exam on the Obama presidency. So what grade do you give the final exam? And how do you think this victory and his potential future success is going to change or affect how we might regard the Obama presidency?
Yeah, I think you see a significant rebuttal. You saw a significant rebuttal to the Obama legacy here. Obamacare premiums going up, that did not help Hillary in any regard. You've seen an awful lot of some of those – the things that conservatives always complain about Obama, that he plays golf all the time, that he's out there, that he's on the world stage and he bows down to leaders. Those are all things that played directly into Donald Trump's playbook. And I think as it goes forward, as Donald Trump in his first term is going to – he's going to have to make some of those very big promises come to fruition. Those are all going to be challenges to the Obama legacy.
Chris, quickly, you get the last word on this. The Obama presidency, how will it be seen?
I think historically it'll be seen as successful. But one of the things that has happened is that white identity has increased, and it'd be hard to ignore the racist and xenophobic messages that Donald Trump used explicitly in his campaign. And I think that is one of the effects.
On that happy note, we will have to end. That was Chris Farisee and Michael Backus. Thanks again to the two of you for making the time to talk with
me. My pleasure. Thanks for having us again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.